Hello, great to have you with us if you're watching live. Again, if you're listening back to the podcast, thank you so much for joining us. Gorgeous weather here in Yorkshire today, which is frustrating for being inside, and I hope you're keeping well and the weather's nice where you are. Really fascinating chat today. In the past, I've been talking to people I already know and have met before, but this is a new one for me where I'm talking to someone who I'm meeting for the first time, which is really exciting. So thank you so much for being with us, Frances.
Pleasure, David. Nice to meet you this way, and I hope in person one day before too long.
So there's so much I want to talk to you about, and there's so many nice milestones coming forward as to what you've been doing. One thing I've been really keen on starting these podcasts with is asking you to describe yourself, what it is that you do, and the projects that you have.
Okay, well, I'm Fran Wilson. My writing name and my online persona is The Cross-Eyed Pianist. I'm a blogger on classical music and with a specific focus on piano playing and the sort of more esoteric aspects of being a pianist. As you said, David, this year is a milestone. My blog celebrates its 10th birthday in July. And what began as a kind of practice diary when I returned to playing the piano seriously after a 20-year absence has turned into this extraordinary thing that's read worldwide. Has a large readership for a specialist site. And everything I do now really has spun off that. So the other work that I do, I was a piano teacher when I lived in London, and now I've reinvented myself as a music PR. It kind of all connects back to the blog, which is really interesting. And I never intended any of this. It's kind of happened organically, which is nice in a way. Because it's meant that I can kind of keep control of it as well. So it seems rather extraordinary reflecting on the last 10 years.
Goodness. Now, what sort of drove you to start the blog in the first place? Obviously, it's quite an undertaking when you think about, or especially now, the amount of work you have to put into and invest. What drove you to start writing about your experience with the piano and also interviewing other musicians?
Well, in fact, I'd been blogging for some years before under the persona The Demon Cook. Because I had a reputation amongst our friends for being a good cook, and somebody said to me, oh, you should write a recipe book. And I thought, well, there are hundreds of recipe books out there, and I don't really cook original things, I just cook other people's recipes. But I started blogging about, you know, the experience of cooking, and so I got the hang of how to blog, and knew that to do it successfully one needs regularly updated content and a decent design. But with my cross-eyed pianist site, as I said, I started playing the piano seriously, so I stopped playing almost completely when I left home to go to university when I was nearly 19, and I didn't really touch the piano again for 20 years. Wow. And when I came back to it, I came back to it with a real passion. I didn't go to music college at 18. I wanted to, but I was discouraged from doing that, so I took a very different path. And I think coming back to it in my late 30s meant that I came back to it with a you know, real seriousness, and realised that actually playing the piano and then writing about playing the piano was what I had wanted to do all along. But I think doing it later on, shall we say, having not been a music student, gave me a different focus. So I started writing about the experience of playing certain repertoire. I wrote about going to concerts, which I had started doing more regularly because my son was a little bit more grown up by then and I could leave him with other people. And actually through that, I got contacted by Barktrack, the now very big concert and opera listing site, and was asked to review for them. And that gave me a really good way into writing about music regularly and specifically reviewing. And that when it happened, which was 2011, so it was only a year, no, 2013. It was only a few years after the blog had started. And at that time, it was what I needed just to, you know, get my name better known as a writer on classical music. But again, it didn't really, it happened by accident. They got in touch with me. I didn't go out looking for it. So that's really how it started. And then I found that people actually read the blog and commented on it. And so conversations would develop. And curiously through it, I've made friends in real life. And I've made all sorts of interesting connections. I mean, I'm fascinated by the online world and social networks And as you well know, I spend far too much time on Twitter, but I find them, I find them very interesting as places where we can have conversations. And specifically when we're amongst like-minded people or people that share the same interests, we're able to discuss things, and often in a more relaxed way. I mean, there are also the more poisonous elements of it, but I don't come up against that very often, to be honest. I find that our network is generally full of good-natured people that are interested in engaging in conversation, and through it I have made some amazing connections and genuinely good friends in real life. I mean, people like John Jacob, who you interviewed a few weeks ago, and they've become people that I go to concerts with or go out for drinks with when I'm in London, and we talk about things to do with music and beyond, and it's very, very interesting, and never more so than now, this need to feel connected to like-minded people. I think the networks are proving incredibly supportive for a lot of us.
No, very true. It's something that's come up a couple of times in some of the blogs, is thinking about what it's actually like if this crisis happened a few years ago.
Yeah.
And say, even just 10 years ago, with internet speeds and general things, it would have been so much harder for us to do.
Yeah, would be.
So it's certainly fascinating. But as you say, I've been amazed as well at just how supportive people are on social media when you reach out to network or to talk to people. And as you say, in general, our sector is quite good at being supportive. And also when there are disagreements, I think people are generally relatively good at having friendly disagreements within supportive ways and discussing.
I think so too. Yeah.
Very much so. And it's amazing to see just how much things have grown. Obviously, if you haven't seen any of Fran's work online, it's definitely worth checking out. One thing that you've been doing for another milestone is there's a series within your blog called Meet the Artist, which is now, was it this week or last week, was it 8 years old?
Yeah, this month it's 8 years old,
Which is
So again, that was something else that I just didn't expect to take off. But as I said just now, I'm aware that I've always been aware that a blog needs to have regularly updated content. I've come across lots of people who say, oh, I'm going to write a blog, and they write three articles and then they find they don't have the time or the inclination to do anything else. And I've always been very conscious of needing to provide more material. And I mean, I see the blog as kind of an online magazine, which is regularly updated. So I was thinking, how can I do something a bit different? And I came across a back issue of Vanity Fair at my mother-in-law's house. And in the old days, I don't know if they still do, there was a back page which was an interview with somebody. And it was loosely based on the Proust questionnaire, which was a set of questions that the author Marcel Proust was given at different stages in his life. And I thought, that's quite an interesting template. So I devised my own set of questions. And then I just asked a few friends and colleagues to answer them. And so Meet the Artist grew from there. And again, I can't believe that it's still going, and it's very popular. It has its own website now, because I just couldn't accommodate the interviews on my main site, and I didn't want my main site to become an interview site. So I have one interview a week on The Cross-Eyed Pianist, and Meet the Artist is now a separate site, and it's a much broader remit. So I've interviewed jazz musicians, pop musicians, crossover, world musicians, some very interesting people. In fact, what it's revealed is often that those that are kind of on the left, either on the left field of our profession or straddle different genres or are completely outside of our profession, have very interesting and insightful things to say. And I think perhaps the most interesting thing about the series is the amount of fascinating information and insights that musicians offer. And I think one of the reasons why it's popular is that for readers and audience members, it gives some view beyond the notes. So, I mean, audiences have a sort of rather idealized image of musicians, I think, because largely we only see them and encounter them in a formal setting of a concert. So I like to think that the interviews just give a peek behind that to the real life of musicians. And actually, curiously, I've just been reading one of your articles before we started chatting, talking about musicians performing from their homes as they are now. I think that this is actually a very positive thing, because it breaks down the barriers that exist in our profession. And to see musicians at work in homes which look like our homes, ordinary homes. They're ordinary people. They don't exist in gilded cages. They don't live in ivory towers, and they don't have a sort of Lystian salon with a chaise lounge and lots of gold swag curtains, do they?
Well, I do downstairs, but I keep it informal up here just in case.
I think that aspect as well, the amount of online material that audiences can access also is helping to dispel the myths about musicians, and specifically classical musicians.
Very true. And one thing I'm always fascinated about is about the concert going setting and environment and experience. And in reality, there's nothing that we've done massively to change it since around the 1920s and things. And sort of
not at all. No.
Electric lights are mainly the most recent innovation as to what's been going on. Maybe tannoy systems for when to come back from the bar.
Yeah.
So as you say, it's fascinating that now we're seeing these unique different insights that we haven't seen before, which is a potentially a really nice, unexpected positive within this situation.
It is, I think so. Yeah.
Well, you have such a finger on the pulse, I imagine, for speaking to so many musicians constantly, and I imagine you must get so many more submissions to Meet the Artist series than you are able to publish. So before we move on to how people are currently doing, what are some of the standout stories and things that have come from the series in the past that have really stuck out? Because there must be quite some unexpected things or avenues at certain points, as well as the big names.
Gosh, that's really...
Put you on the spot, I know.
Difficult question, because I think there's over 300 interviews.
Which you have all to hand.
So one of the questions is, what is your most treasured possession? Which is directly taken from the Proust questionnaire. And lots of people will obviously cite their instrument. But one respondent, one of the early ones, a composer, I won't name him, but you can look up the interview. In response to that question, he said, a holy relic of Cardinal John Newman. So Newman wrote the text of Elgar's Dream of Gerontius. And I thought that was an incredible response. Somebody else had a conductor's baton that had belonged to a famous conductor from another era. So they were curious pieces of memorabilia, which people obviously hold very dear. So those things were very interesting. I have to say that often the most incisive insights are coming from younger musicians, the ones who are just starting out or are fairly early on in their careers. And while they may display incredible idealism about the profession, they're also very realistic about it. And I find that both refreshing and slightly depressing as well. I mean, but they're aware that it's tough, which I think is healthy, because it is tough and it's very, very tough now. And it's not going to get much easier, I don't think, in the immediate future. I mean, there's just so many responses. I really can't pick out many. Oh, one that did make me laugh, the pianist Ivo Pogorelic, who of course has a reputation for being an incredible maverick in both his playing and perhaps his personality. I think in answer to a question about favourite pieces or something, he mentioned that he would never ever play Happy Birthday for anybody.
I thought unexpected. That was
perhaps quite typical of his rather... uncompromising personality, but I mean, what I find so interesting about the series is that everybody has something of value to say, every single respondent. I mean, it's rare to find an interview that's boring, because musicians are not boring and are very articulate often about the difficulties and the pleasures of the musician's life.
Very much so, and I think that brings us quite nicely onto the difficulties that musicians and people within the music profession are all having at the moment. From obviously speaking to so many musicians on a regular basis, you must be quite clued into how people are feeling and what challenges they face. Have you seen any difference in the submissions to the Meet the Artist series since this has taken place, or is it still feeding through?
I haven't actually, because a lot of the material had been commissioned, and it's often now commissioned by musicians, publicists and PRs. A lot of it had been commissioned before all this kicked off. I've been asked to pull one or two interviews out of the schedule because they were tied to a specific event. So I haven't really had any responses yet that directly relate to this, and I suspect they may come later in the year as things settle again, hopefully, and people are reflecting on this latest, this immediate crisis. But certainly in terms of acquaintances and colleagues, I get the feeling that in the first couple of weeks, people felt incredibly shocked to have their diaries emptied immediately. It was just like a guillotine coming down. Mm. And as I said to you, my son is in the hospitality industry. He's a professional chef. And for him, it was exactly the same. The parallels are extraordinary, actually. Two professions that had just been stopped in their tracks almost in a matter of moments. So I think that it's taken, I mean, I know from conversations with friends who are professional musicians, it's taken a couple of weeks to really just get over that shock. And of course, now they are having to find ways to make a living. So with concerts cancelled, a colleague of mine runs summer schools, they're all suspended. They have to find other ways to work. And, you know, the lucky ones can fall back on teaching, but then one has to learn how to teach online if you haven't done that before. So there's a whole nother set of skills and difficulties to be overcome. And I think when one is in a state of shock, as many are at the moment, those things are that much more difficult. And that, I also think that a lot of the material that we're seeing pushed out online, broadcast in people's homes and these live streams and things like that, are almost a kind of knee-jerk reaction to what's happened. It's almost like musicians need to reaffirm who they are, and their main way of making that affirmation is by playing. So if they can't be performing on stage in a concert venue, doing it from your sitting room or your music studio is the next best thing. And I think there's still a lot of that need to just say, this is who I am and this is what I do. This is my raison d'etre. And I find it, you know, it's upsetting, actually, to feel that people are in this situation. There's a sense of desperation in some quarters, but I think it's settling as people get used to this new normal, which is where we all are now. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah, very much so. And I'm not sure how other musicians found it in the first sort of 1-2 weeks, but I know for me the first week was sort of similar in terms of panic, but also is more frantic energy and trying to fix things and running around. Yeah. Week yeah. two was then hitting a complete wall of momentum and drive and things, and then having to sort of sit back and take stock. So I think it's gonna be one of the things that it's never gonna be normal for quite a while, but we'll hopefully get to a point of say consistency, or yeah. I'm hoping I get to a point of consistency anyway going forwards, which is certainly interesting. But as you say, it's great to see musicians still feeling the need and compelled drive to perform and to connect musically mm-hmm. through whatever medium. And I know there's a discussion going on about should we put out music for free, mm-hmm. does that affect people's livelihoods? But if it is this yeah. expression of art and things, there's certainly a need yeah. for that and a yeah. place for it, which I think is very important. Mm-hmm. One thing that I haven't got on my list of questions, but I'm suddenly thinking of, you obviously do elements of reviewing, and in the past have done it for Barktrack and things, and I know that Barktrack have been furloughed as well. How yeah. do you feel this is going to affect music critics and reviewers and their element? Because obviously they're a vital part of the sector, and not only are there now no concerts going on, and the fact that they can go to, it's a very different medium for reviewing online content, which there may not be an appetite for.
Well, again, it's going to challenge some sort of, you know, old-fashioned or different ways of doing things. I mean, I've never been someone that's enjoyed reviewing CDs, to be honest. I'd much rather be at a live concert, but, you know, if material is sent to me for review, I will consider it. I mean, there's a whole raft of critics out there who are very, very highly skilled in reviewing CDs, and I don't see why they shouldn't adapt to reviewing online content as well, and I'm sure they will, but it's whether there's a market for it and that whether people will be paid. You just mentioned it, that the amount of free material that troubles me greatly. I don't think that all this material should be free, but it's finding a business model that works that is a difficulty for many musicians, because they've been used to a different way of working where they are paid by a promoter or venue or manager. That's kind of another conversation. I don't know. I mean, the reviewing world is constantly in a state of flux, I think. I've felt it very strongly because I put my foot into it as somebody who could be perceived as an amateur. I don't have that much formal training as a musician. I mean, I have latterly, when I came back to the piano, I have a degree in English, which I suppose gives me an ability to write an essay. And I've sensed, particularly in the last year, a much greater sense of them and us between the mainstream media and specifically mainstream music journalists and people like me who are independent. And I think it's symptomatic of a wider problem with the mainstream media that it's under threat. My view is that we all exist in the same ecosystem of music, and therefore we should all be on the same side, which is of the music. I think people will adapt. You know, we're actually very good as human beings at adapting. It's very evident that 3.5 weeks into this lockdown, we seem to have all adapted remarkably well. And I think that musicians and writers, creative people in general, are adaptable. And, you know, we'll learn how to apply our particular skill sets in different ways. I hope so, anyway. I'm generally an optimist, I have to admit. That's my nature, is to be optimistic about these things. And, you know, those that can't adapt will have to just, you know, they'll have to do something else, I think, is the short answer.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, really, in it, that this adaption is something that's really needed. And I was thinking last week that at some point we were going to need to adapt, and there was no real force to do so until we're just sort of fizzling out in a way in the classical music world. Whereas now all of a sudden we're being thrust online, and one of my hopes is that this could be a good watershed moment that means we catch up with the rest of the world and sport and pop music and other things. That means we've really got to actually try and get our act together.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a massive opportunity, actually, if people were willing to take it. You know, that there could be very exciting developments ahead as a result of this. I hope so.
Massively. And I can't remember which podcast I was speaking about this, but with classical music being one of the fastest growing genres on streamed music, there is a huge appetite for it online and in digital format. So it's not that we're trying to flog something that's really uninteresting and won't resonate online and we're banging our head against the wall. There is this appetite there, which means hopefully there's then an audience and an income possibility going forward, which is great.
Yeah, hope so.
Very much so. Well, one thing you mentioned is obviously that people are now adapting and trying new things, and this isn't something that's new for you, because obviously you'll have had to do this in the past in creating your blog and learning how to find a market and promote yourself. And it's not just the blogging that you do, but you also now do PR for other musicians and festivals and things as well.
Yes.
What sorts of skills and things have you learnt over the years that you feel could help other musicians going forwards? Again, looking into crystal ball and putting you onto the spot with things.
Do you mean in terms of publicity?
Yes, yeah, so sort of how to promote themselves in the digital world.
Well, I mean, I don't like the word content, but it is a current word. And I think that good content is incredibly important. I get sent a lot of press releases because I'm kind of at both ends now as a blogger and a PR. So I often get sent material from other PRs, and a lot of it is very good. But there are some pieces that I get sent where I just think, okay, you know, seven paragraphs of blurb, and the crucial information is in the final paragraph at the bottom of the email. I'm not going to scroll down that far, I'm afraid. So my premise is that you need to get your message across in the first paragraph, and if you can't do that, then you need to go away and think about how you're going to do it. And I think that well-written press releases, good quality photographs and other material like video links are very important. I also think that if musicians are self-promoting, that using the social networks like Twitter in particular gives them a way of getting in touch with audiences and potential audiences. And going back to what I was saying earlier about breaking down barriers, I think that Twitter's very good at that. You can talk to a famous musician. You can chat to a famous musician through Twitter. I mean, and this is one of the ways that I drew candidates for the Meet the Artist series. And then I would actually go to the green room after the concert and meet the person in person. And so having made that contact online, it made the conversation in the green room that much easier. And audiences like that. They like to feel connected to the two musicians. And most musicians also want to meet their audiences. So I think one should not be afraid about making those connections and to be amenable to it. Again, the younger ones are often more receptive and happier to do that. So I think a slightly more relaxed approach to these kinds of things are important. I think there's, again, though, there's also a fine line between self-promoting and just kind of coming across as a massive ego. And, you know, nobody likes what I call an ego tweeter. So it's the person who tweets about themselves all the time. And I've found that this is something I've learned in the last sort of 18 months of doing PR almost as a full-time job, is that, you know, one's trying to advertise or promote the same thing, for usually a concert in my case, for several weeks in advance of the actual date. And you're so you're trying to say the same thing every time, which is buy the tickets to this concert. This art, you know, you must come and see this artist, he's great, buy the tickets. But you want to be saying it in a different way each time, which is intelligent and attractive and interesting. And that's a skill, I think. You don't want to just be retweeting the same thing every time, because that's frankly boring. And those kinds of things, I'm a great autodidact. I learn by doing it myself. I've always been like this. And so I look at what others are doing and, you know, pick the good stuff out and discard the rest and kind of learn on the job. And it's been very interesting. And actually, I'm pleased to say quite successful so far as well. You know, I've been surprised at the work that's come my way, and I've enjoyed it very much. And I miss it at the moment, to be honest. Because again, when the concert halls closed, there was no promotion to be done. I've been affected by that secondhand. But I've also got other things to do, which is good.
Yes, multi-revenue streams are now more vital than ever, I think. Similarly, I was in the same situation of between contracts, and it just seemed to happen to be bad timing on that front, so I certainly empathise. I think you have the nail on the head there in terms of one, people are so much more generous with their time when they contact, or they're contacted by people. I'm still amazed looking at my connections in the past where I've been cheeky and sent a direct message, which I thought was very ambitious, where people sort of say yes straight away to ideas and offer their time or thoughts. And then also, as you mentioned, being creative and not just retweeting and doing the same thing over and over again. It's trying to find new and creative ways of talking about who you are, which is really fascinating. I think actually, by not going to music college, this may have potentially been of benefit, because I found that my narrative, probably unintentionally from being there, was that things had to be perfect before you got started. And your learning by doing process and making mistakes is something that I found quite unnatural at the beginning, but it's now something I do as well. So I think that could be a nice positive from not having been at music college.
I'm convinced of it now. Now that I've spent 10 years in the world of classical music, I am certain that if I had gone to conservatoire, my love of music would probably have been quite seriously eroded. I adore music, and I specifically adore classical music and the piano. And I always have done from when I was very young. But I have met students, conservatoire level students, who have become disillusioned very quickly. The kind of constraints of the system, rather inward looking, traditional aspects of gatekeeping, which is an area of classical music that interests me a lot at the moment, it can be very restrictive and very off-putting. And the other thing that troubles me is that not many conservatoires are actually teaching entrepreneurship and how to promote PR, those kinds of things, because there's this idea, I think, in our world that you know, being businesslike is a dirty word. And unfortunately, the agents don't just come knocking at your door. You have to have done something exceptional, like win a competition, or just, you know, it doesn't work like that. So I think that music colleges have to be much more open-minded in those areas. So, yeah, I'm glad I didn't go. I did other things after I graduated. I worked in academic publishing for 10 years and actually worked in direct marketing when I was doing that. In the old days, when we would send out letters in envelopes and did old-fashioned mail shots. This is pre-internet. I'm that old. and so I'm of the opinion that one accumulates skills along the road if you're willing to, and that, as I said, that's my nature, and that's how I got to where I am now.
It's really interesting you say about sending things out in envelopes. Just before this crisis, I received an invite to a press event, and it came in the most beautiful envelope with the most gorgeous paper inside. And I felt so special. I had a physical, actual paper thing that's flipped around from it.
I have actually been doing that myself, rather than sending emails. For certain projects I've worked on in the last few months, I've actually sent a personal letter on lovely paper, beautiful Conqueror envelopes. I think it will make, I hope it makes a difference, because it's different. You know, we're getting emails all the time with PDF attachments. Mm. It just, yeah, it feels different. And so there's an argument for going back to a more old-fashioned, slower, perhaps, way of doing this. Yeah. Just because you might stand out a bit, and that's, you know, in this competitive world, that's what you've got to do.
Very much so. Well, carrying on from the theme of standing out in this competitive world, obviously you have, I use the words critical in a positive way, a very critiquing eye for what's good in terms of PR or music and this side of things. And so what has really sort of taken your eye over the last few weeks as things are online that you've really enjoyed or you think are working well in the digital space?
Oh, goodness. I have to confess that I haven't actually looked at very much of what's going on in our world. I've felt slightly overwhelmed by it. One thing I have enjoyed is the violinist Fenella Humphreys, who's been doing concerts from her home. I mean, I know Fenella a little bit. She did my interview some years ago, and she's also performed in a charity concert that I co-organised. And I liked the fact the other day that she asked people to vote for the program that she would play, and this relates back to this idea of connections with your audience and engagement and breaking down barriers, and I thought that was a very nice gesture. And there have been one or two other rather sort of quirky things like that, where people have sort of organized a little concert from their home with a very specific theme. I like the singer who's doing his bathrobe recitals in the morning. I can't remember his name, but he plays in his bathrobe at his grand piano and sings. I think that these things all have value. I found it very difficult to listen to classical music over the last few weeks. It reminds me of what we don't have, which is live concerts, and I absolutely adore live concerts, and certainly when I lived in London, I would be out at a concert several times a week, sometimes twice a day. I'd go up to the Wigmore for a lunchtime concert, come home, teach piano for a few hours, and then go back up to the South Bank Centre, and I feel so bereft, actually, of that. It's the experience of being in a concert. I love every aspect of it. I even love the very formal things about concert going. I mean, there are things that I also rail against, but I've always loved the moment that you walk into the concert hall, especially a hall like the Wigmore, which I regard as my kind of spiritual home, buying a program, having a drink, meeting friends, sitting in those red velvet seats, the lights going down, all of those things are very, very important. And I think many people that enjoy live music would agree with that. And I feel very bereft of that at the moment. So I must admit that my listening has mostly been my son's playlists, which is a lot of hip hop, the soundtrack to The Inbetweeners, interspersed with some quite unusual surprises, things like The Smiths, he seems to like, which I was listening to when I was a student. Golden Brown by The Stranglers came up on one of his playlists the other day, and actually that's been rather nice to be sort of reminded of my teens and my student days through his playlists. So I'm actually broadening my musical horizons a bit at the moment.
So is this potentially where you're now going to announce the diversification of the Cross-Eyed Pianist to being a wider music blog into all sorts of genres?
No, I don't think so. I don't feel qualified to write about that kind of music, and other people do it far better. But it's interesting. Mm. And actually, something came up on one of my son's playlists, which is, I think, a hip-hop track, which has a riff borrowed from, I think, from a Verdi opera. And I just said, oh, that's from Verdi. And my son goes, no, it's such and such, named the rapper. Or the hip-hop artist. And I said, no, that's directly lifted from a piece of classical music, as if to prove that classical music is indeed everywhere.
Yes. It's got to be hidden in. Wonderful. Well, before we wrap up, there's one thing I think would be quite interesting to close on, because you mentioned about gatekeepers being one of the things you're fascinated with in the music world. And I'm intrigued to hear about your thoughts about gatekeepers in general in the sector, but also about... bear me one second just for a comment. Alistair Hogarth says you need to get Stormzy on the Meet the Artist series.
Well, I would love to have Stormzy in it. Maybe I'll just drop him a tweet.
You never know. You never know. but yeah, so your thoughts on gatekeepers in general, but also if you feel that now that we've been pushed to being online, if the gatekeepers aren't necessarily there, now we're on different paths.
I think gatekeepers exist everywhere. And I mean, we come across them a lot in our world. They take the form of critics, teachers, agents, promoters, other musicians. They exist in the conservatoires. They exist in private teaching, musicologists, all sorts of people that think they know the right way, for example, to play Bach or Beethoven. And my view, which has developed really since I stopped having formal lessons a few years ago, is that actually we can be a lot freer than that. That this music is not set in stone. The score is not the last word on how we play it. It's actually a roadmap and a jumping off point for a massive exploration and experiment. And I think that this period may encourage people to step away from those rather narrow views about how certain repertoire should be played. It doesn't apply to all repertoire. I think there are certain composers who are on pedestals whose music we mustn't touch. We must be very reverential of it. And I actually think that the composers wrote the music to be played, and they're not particularly fussed about, you know, whether you begin an ornament on the beat or not. You know, it's become very, very precious. I mean, this is something that developed really at the end of the 19th century. And I think we need to find greater freedom and enjoy the music for its expressive and emotional qualities, because that's what connects it to audiences. So that's really where I'm coming from in terms of gatekeeping. As a teacher, it would trouble me that students came at music with a very sort of preconceived idea of how it should sound. And I rail against the tyranny of the shoulds. We need to free ourselves from that, and to have the confidence to play with our own conviction. The last concert I went to at the Wigmore at the end of February, when this crisis was just beginning to be something we should worry about, and I spent the evening hugging friends and you know, sitting in a packed Wigmore hall, not even considering that we might be at risk. But I went to hear the American pianist Jonathan Biss playing Beethoven, and it was an extraordinary concert. It was absolutely electrifying playing, but it was very personal. And I know from reading some of the reviews of his earlier concerts that a lot of people didn't like it because of that. He was playing Beethoven in the wrong way. Actually, it was some of the most exciting live music I've heard for a long time. And I think that we need more of that. We need to set fire to the music again, and maybe set fire to it, let it fall into a pile of ashes and bring something new out of that. And let the phoenix rise from it. Sorry, I'm sounding a bit pretentious, but I want people to feel free to make their own interpretive decisions. You know, I hear an awful lot of stuff in concert, which is you know, like somebody else's version of that Beethoven sonata or that Chopin nocturne. You know, and try and make it your own. You know, audiences like that, they really do. Most audiences do. There are very few that want to hear the same thing played the same time every time.
Yes, very true. well, just before we finally wrap up, because I realise I missed off the one important question I had at the very end. Obviously, it's been 10 years since the start of your blog itself. What plans do you have for the future with it? I won't say for 10 years, because that's quite a big, deep question. But where are you sort of wanting it to go, and what are your plans in the immediate future during this period for the blog?
Well, I actually don't know the answer to that. I had a period of feeling quite miserable about it earlier in the year, because I had a touch of writer's block because I was doing lots of other things and therefore not able to write many articles. And I thought, I'm running out of steam. And I thought the worst thing would be to keep going but not to be writing particularly good quality or interesting articles. And then something happened and, you know, I was found that I was writing again and enjoying it. It will continue as long as I'm interested enough to do it. I don't really know where it's going in the next 10 years. I need to find some new direction for it, I think, to keep it interesting and keep it current. There will be perhaps a period of reflection after where we are now, you know, lessons, and we're released back into some kind of normal way of doing things. I don't know, to be honest. I hope it will continue. Whether it continues for another 5 or 10 years remains to be seen. But meanwhile, I'm very grateful to everybody that's involved in it, all the artists who've done interviews and people who comment and who contact me and create conversations and connections with me. Please keep doing it.
Definitely. Well, huge congratulations. As you mentioned very briefly at the beginning, it's actually a lot of effort to start these, and going for the amount of content you'll be doing is a colossal achievement, and especially for such a wonderfully long period, which has not only seen you develop through it, but is fantastic longevity. Well, thank you. Absolute pleasure, and thank you so much for being here. If people want to find you, your blog on the internet, whereabouts can they find you at the moment?
The blog is crosseyedpianist.com. I'm on Twitter as Cross-Eyed Piano. The blog also has a Facebook page. I'm also on Instagram, which is a bit more random because it's not so much music, it's just general pictures.
Great photos of food. That's the main thing.
Oh, well, that's mostly my son's fault. And, you know, come drop by and find me somewhere online and come say hello, or meet me at a concert when we can all get back inside the concert halls. I'm always happy to meet readers. It's a pleasure.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. You get to laugh at me now because I still haven't quite worked out how to end these recordings / podcasts. And so far, they just kind of ramble out into the end. So if you're watching, thank you so much. And again, listening, if you're listening back, thank you again. If you want to find out about who's next on the blog, check me out on social media, which is usually David_Taylor_UK. I can't quite remember what I was meant to say, but thank you again for being here. And I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you, David. Bye.